Okay, I think we'll start in the interest of time. We don't quite have a quorum present, but we all know the roads are bad this morning. And I do know there's another meeting that's going on that a couple of us were at that perhaps hasn't adjourned yet that does have some of the Ways and Means committee members on that particular commission. So we will get started, and this morning we're going to be dealing with the February forecast that was released last week, and we will have with us Jim Showalter, the commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget, Dr. Tom Stinson, the state economist, and Margaret Kelly, the state budget director. So if the three of you want to come forward.
The developer loves my bill.
And if I recall correctly, I think Commissioner Showalter kicked it off when we had a briefing, so are you going to use the same order in terms of who speaks first?
Mr. Chair, that's right. Thank you for inviting us here today. My name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Management and Budget. With me to my right is Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director, and to my left, Dr. Tom Stinson. So as we get set up, I think everyone has seen some of this material, but I appreciate the chance to walk through it again, refamiliarize ourselves since it was late last week, and even for ourselves, it's like, what was that forecast again? And I think it was good news that we found that we have a slightly smaller amount to repay on the school ships when the day is done. We have a slightly smaller deficit to budget into for 2014 and 15, and that the economy continues to move forward, not spectacularly, but solidly. We still have some risks. We'll talk about those. And really, we appreciate the chance to answer questions along the way, because one of the things that we experience is good news tends to elicit very few questions initially because everyone's trying to process it. But the forecast is really a lot of context, a lot of data for you to understand all of the different things that are going on. And hopefully this hearing will give us a chance to do that. On the first page of the slide deck, and hopefully everyone has these slides in their packets. It looks like you got one to a page, which is great. What you see on here is just the recap of the forecast for 2014 and 15. We had projected as of November a $1.1 billion deficit. That shrunk by $463 million in the lower right corner, leaving a projected deficit for 2014 and 15 of $627 million. I think we're all familiar with the forecast process, but just for a reminder's sake, this compares current law revenues and current law expenditures. In this case, there are some changes, particularly on the revenue side, where we see a little bit stronger collections on the income tax side. Dr. Stinson will walk into that in just a minute. And on the projected spending, where we see a little bit lower spending levels, particularly in healthcare, and Margaret Kelly will talk about that. All in all, it's about a 1.3% change versus our previously estimated revenues. It's not a huge change by any stretch, but it is certainly going in a favorable direction. The next page shows you the current biennium, the 2012 and 13 forecast. This is the period that will close on June 30th of this calendar year. And in this period, we see about an 0.8% change. It is, by current law, using any directs any kind of surplus from the current biennium to repay the shift. It's the fourth consecutive time that statute will come into play. What we anticipate happening is that the school shift will be changed by about 4%, from around 82.5% to about 86.5%. By virtue of having this balance in 2012 and 13. That is the overview of this forecast and some of the key figures that we announced. Hopefully today we can drill a little bit further into some of the moving pieces. To kick that off, I will turn it over to Dr. Stinson to talk about the revenue changes in the forecast.
I think we have a question at this point. Representative Anderson?
Definitely.
Oh, okay. He said he would be happy to take questions as we move forward, but yeah. Okay. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to start talking at on page 4. And on page 4, you can see the changes in revenues that occurred. These are really very small changes in revenue. For 2012-2013, $128 million in the income tax on a 2013 base of $16.6 billion. Sales tax is down slightly, $19 million. The corporate tax is up $85 million or on a $1.2 billion base. For 14 and 15, the $297 million is 1.7% change increase. The $48 million decline in sales tax is 0.5%. The $47 million corporate tax increase is 2.4%. Overall, after everything's taken into account, we changed 2014-2015 by less than 1%. The reason for the changes were that wages had a little bit smaller growth. Non-wage income had a larger growth, particularly business income, which had a much stronger growth than we had. Capital gains is the increase, or the growth rate that we had was higher than it was, but because of a change in the base level from new information we got, there was starting from a lower base in there. More than one half of the 14-15 increase comes from business income. On the sales tax, minus $48 million, $40 million of that was from a change in expected payments of sales tax refunds. Sales tax refunds are expected to be higher than they were in November, so that reduces the amount of net sales tax we have. The gross sales tax changed by about $8 million or less than 0.1%. We've talked quite a bit about the acceleration of activity that was going to go on because of the fiscal cliff. And we think we've seen evidence of that occurring, although it really won't be until this time next year that we know exactly what went on. But in January, the variance in the income tax, we were up $190 million compared to forecast. $120 million of that was in estimated tax payments, payments made by people who aren't normally withheld, and $60 million of it was an increase in withholding. The withholding increase appears to have come from a 9% increase in wages, total Minnesota wages in the fourth quarter of 2012 compared to the fourth quarter of 2011. That's the strongest growth that we've seen since the third quarter of 2000, and we think that what happened was that it borrowed money from the first quarter particularly of 2013. What we think is that people that had the option of when they would receive their bonus or when they would exercise stock options would choose to have that money in tax year 2012, where if you're a high income individual it would be subject to a lower tax rate. The capital gains that we've seen, we now have capital gains growing in 2012 by 83% compared to the 58% that we had in November. That's the second strongest growth we've seen in capital gains since 1960, which is when our data series starts. The only other time we saw capital gains growth that high was in 1986, when the Tax Reform Act of 1986 raised the capital gains tax rate beginning in 1987. So that's kind of the quick overview of the changes in forecast revenues. If you look at, turn to page 5, you can see the change in the economy. One reason why there was not much in the way of changes in the economy is that changes in revenues, because there wasn't much in the way of changes in the economy. If you round to the nearest tenth of a percent for growth rates, all those growth rates for November and February are the same. In 2012, growth was 2.1%. 2013, it was forecast both in November and in February, 1.9%. Then it goes up 2.8%, 3.3%. Generally, it's assumed that there's symmetric risk, that housing could be better, could be worse than what's going on. A very strong housing sector is assumed, 25% in growth in 2013, 30% in 2014, 20% in 2015. Housing activity would about double over those 3 years, but it could come faster than that, or it could stall and not come at all, and that's one of the big risks to the forecast. The second risk, set of risks to the forecast are important. They're policy risks. The European sovereign debt crisis is back in the news. Certainly everybody's heard about the sequester. There's questions about whether the continuing resolution will be approved or not. There's questions about what will happen to the debt ceiling. All of those things are items that increase uncertainty and hold down confidence in the economy. But at this point, Global Insight is taking a kind of a middle of approach to these, and not either bringing the economy down very much or assuming that it's going to take off. If we turn to page 6, there are a couple of notes.
On that point, when you say they take a middle approach, do we have something here that will show us what the range would be? In terms of the risk?
Mr. Chairman, we don't have a specific slide. I'm going to tell you in words, but we didn't put it on a specific slide. On page 6, Global Insight is assuming on the slide a short sequester. What that means is they're assuming that the sequester lasts for 2 months, the month of March and the month of April. And then beginning in the month of May, some agreement is reached. We go back to spending on a more or less normal pattern until 2014, when spending cuts, including entitlement spending cuts, are beginning to come into play. So that's what's in their forecast, a two-month sequester, no partial government shutdown, and no problems on the debt ceiling. That set of assumptions takes 0.1% from their forecast. So in the absence of the sequester, they would be assuming 2% real GDP growth. And with the sequester, they're assuming they're showing 1.9% real GDP growth. If the sequester lasts through the end of the year, it would be about 0.5% decline. And so instead of a 2% growth, they would have 1.5% growth, which is still positive and still way better than we had in 2009, when the economy shrunk by 3.1%. But of course, we wouldn't have the same kind of job growth or revenue growth as is in the forecast. Minnesota's impact would be less, and you've all heard this multiple times, I'm sure by now, would be less than in most states. Federal procurement and federal wages and salaries are, as a proportion of state gross domestic product, are believe the state ranked 49th compared to all states. In looking at this and running this through our Minnesota econometric model, we believe that Minnesota job growth would be cut back by no more than 5,000 jobs. Now, it's not that we would lose 5,000 jobs from where we are today, but rather that instead of having 40,000 jobs created during the 2013 calendar year, we would have 35,000 jobs created. I can talk more about the sequester, but I'm not sure as people are even very interested in the sequester in terms of the economic impacts. Kind of the basic lesson to be drawn from this is that this is not a very good way of managing federal expenditures, but that by itself it's not going to create a recession. By itself it's not going to slow the U.S. economy very much, and it's not going to slow Minnesota's economy as much as it will slow the U.S. economy. So unless there are further questions, I'm going to turn it over to Margaret Kelly to talk about the spending.
Okay, maybe before she starts, we have for some time now had a quorum presence, so I want to officially convene the meeting. And then we did have a couple of questions of Dr. Stinson. Is that okay, Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we move on from the sequester, I just had a question, Dr. Stinson. It's been a little, I think, confusing for the public and maybe even for legislators on looking at what impact the sequester may have on Minnesota. And, you know, your estimate is maybe no more than 5,000 reduction in job growth. And I've seen some other reports and newspapers and that, you know, up to 17,000 jobs lost in Minnesota. I mean, where are those figures coming from? And is that, you know, some kind of a doomsday worst-case scenario that, or how are those numbers coming, where are those coming from?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the 16,000, 17,000 number that you've seen comes from a study done by George Mason University last September for the Aerospace and Defense Council or something like that. There are a couple of problems with it. One is if it's coming from the Aerospace and Defense Council, you can probably be pretty sure that they're erring on the side of having larger impacts rather than smaller impacts. Second, it was based on the law and the size of the sequester that was in place at that time, and as part of the fiscal cliff, a portion of the sequester that's scheduled was actually set aside. Part of it was replaced by an assumption about what was going to happen with IRA conversions, and part of it was taken into account, I think. I can't remember what happened to the other half of it. So anyway, part of it's there. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that it would cost the U.S. about 750,000 jobs in their Minnesota typically would be less than 2%, so that would be less than 15,000 jobs. But because we have such a small presence in defense and such a small presence in the federal budget, it's much more likely that we would be less than 1% in there. So the 5,000 jobs is probably a high estimate. But we thought that that we would use that round number in there.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson, did you want to ask yours now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, this is separate from the first reason that I raised my hand for, but since we're on the sequester, I'm just wondering how much are we going to be impacted when it comes to our health care budget and the sequester? Is there any impact at all? Given the fact that we're kind of discussing the health insurance exchange, is there going to be any delay in those dollars, or what can we expect over the next until June if we do a short sequester versus a long-term one?
I think maybe the budget director can answer that question a little bit better than I can with more detail.
Maybe we can cut or do that while you're doing your section.
Sure.
That's all right. And then Representative Mahoney had a question, I think, of probably Dr. Stinson.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, my question or my comment was to Representative Loon's question about the 17,000 jobs lost. We held a hearing on the sequester in my committee, and it just so happens that the workforce centers and all of our workforce help correlates to that 17,000 people that we won't be able to help because of that sequester. So if we lose 17,000 jobs, we probably won't have a lot of money to help them find new jobs. That's part of the problem with it, because we lose about almost $40 million is the cut to workforce training from the federal government.
A little under 40.
Okay, Ms. Kelly, and then you'd know of Representative Anderson's questions, so if you can touch on that.
Certainly. Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director, and I'll actually start with the sequester to keep that going. In addition to what Dr. Stinson had discussed around the impact of the sequester at a national level and how that will ripple through to Minnesota's economy, there's also a direct impact on state agencies who receive funds from the federal government. $85 billion at the federal level are being sequestered, and that translates into roughly about $85 million of federal funding that flows through Minnesota to either state agencies, to school districts, or to local governments. And so that's what we are currently anticipating. There's not a lot of clear information coming from federal agencies yet to better understand the timing of these reductions and the magnitude of them, but it's somewhere between a 5 and 10% reduction in each federal grant program, depending on what the federal appropriation levels are. Agencies have started to assess what sort of impact that means on their budgets. There are several areas of funding that come from the feds that are off the table. So, for example, our Medicaid program is exempt from federal sequestration. Much of our federal transportation funding is exempt from sequestration. Some of the big grant programs that are covered by sequestration are special education funding to schools, Title I funding to schools, WIC program that flows through the Department of Health, vocational rehab and workforce development grants that flow through the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So there will be impacts to the level of services that state agencies can provide as a result of the sequestration, and agencies are working to determine exactly what that is now. Specifically to funding for the exchange, I'm not clear whether that funding is exempt from sequestration or covered by sequestration. I don't know if you know.
Just a question on the sequestration. Is it, you know, some federal dollars go directly to school districts and or the University of Minnesota, and the numbers that you're using, does that include those aid payments as well?
Mr. Chair, I am not certain if that is inclusive of funding that goes to the University of Minnesota. I would have to check on that. I heard anecdotally the U of M is looking at a $50 million impact in their research funding from federal grants.
There was a comment in one of the newspapers about the U of M having major impact, and I didn't know if that was included then with your numbers. Mainly, I think, in research grants and so on. Representative Abler.
Thanks. I'm sorry I'm late. I just heard your comment about the sequestration for the exchange funding. When are you going to know about that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think there is any impact. We're going to double check, but I'm not aware of any.
I thought you just mentioned that it might be.
I mentioned that, Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I mentioned I wasn't certain if it was covered or exempt by the sequester, and
all right.
Commissioner Showalter believes it's exempt from the sequester.
Didn't mean to uncover an internal thing. Thanks.
Oh, sorry.
I'm going to move on to the spending changes and the forecast. Because the sequester impacts federal funds, the forecast speaks only to our general fund spending, and so you won't see any of those changes reflected in this forecast. But overall, spending is lowered in both biennia when you compare the February forecast to the November forecast. The changes are very minor, relatively minor, similar to the level or degree of change on the revenue side. So $63 million of lowered spending in the 12 and 13 biennium and $129 million in the 14 and 15 biennium. Now if we go down the list, starting with K-12 education, this is almost half of our general fund spending. It's changing by less than one-tenth of 1%, and it's due to enrollment growth changes. Enrollment growth is still increasing, but it's been lowered in this forecast to 3.1%. We had been assuming a 3.2% enrollment growth in November. Property tax aids and credits, it's less than 10% of our general fund budget, and the change is roughly one-half of 1%. There is a decline in homeowner refunds that is offset by an increase in renter refunds, and so there is a shift away from homeownership and also lower overall property taxes shifting away from homeowners to more commercial properties, which is lowering the growth of property taxes on homeowners, resulting in lower homeowner property tax refunds. Moving on to Health and Human Services, the biggest magnitude of change in this forecast. It's almost a third of our general fund budget, and it's declining by just under 1%. Medical assistance, or MA, is the largest expenditure within the Health and Human Services area, and it counts for most of the savings, as we typically see in the forecast. And in both biennia, we are seeing savings result from the Department of Human Services' recent managed care rate negotiations, which lowered our public health care costs by $19 million in the current biennium and $72 million in the next biennium. And these lowered savings are offset. There are additional savings in the MA forecast that are due to pharmacy rebates in 14 and 15. We continue to see savings from the Affordable Care Act pharmacy rebate provisions, and additional savings from lowered enrollment and lowered average caseload costs. And those savings are offset by increases in 14 and 15 for the recently enacted MA expansion, Chapter 1 of this legislative session. It added $64 million of costs to the MA program. There is a corresponding transfer in Chapter 1, transferring money from the Health Care Access Fund into the General Fund, $64 million, to offset the cost of the MA expansion. And you see that revenue on the revenue side of the story. Here you just see the expenditure side of the story. So you see the expenditures going up as a result of that, offsetting our savings. The MA expansion increases the number of single adults with coverage, as well as expands the coverage for parents, relative caretakers, and 19 and 20-year-olds. So there's a net increase in average monthly enrollment of 24,000 as a result of that bill. The all other spending reduction in fiscal year 14 and 15 reflects an adjustment that we made in the timing of the bond
sale.
Excuse me,
I think Representative Abler had.
Yeah, is it okay to interrupt, or did you want to
wait? The commissioner indicated at the beginning that they would be willing to take questions as we move forward. Okay. So, Representative Abler?
Yeah, thanks. I just have a short question. We did the Medicaid expansion. Did that actually increase the size of the school shift payback because we did that? Did that free up any general fund? Or did it not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, the bill itself had no impact on spending. It had a net zero impact on spending or revenue in the general fund. And so while we did incorporate the spending and the revenue into the forecast, it was a net zero impact.
Thank you.
I'm going to move on to the all other category of spending. This reflects an adjustment we made in the timing of the bond sale for the Vikings Stadium. We were assuming in the November forecast a March 1st bond sale, and we're now assuming an August 1st bond sale, and this has been adjusted to reflect the current construction timeline of the stadium. And so this change, about a five-month delay in the bond sale, lowers our interest payments in the next fiscal year by $10 million, and that accounts for most of the reduction in the all other category. So the school shift buyback will...
Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Kelly. So
we had a discussion last week about the Vikings bonds and that there was a general fund transfer assumed in this forecast of $13 million to pay debt service to make up for the lack of revenue on the pull tabs. It was 5 and 8, I believe, was what the discussion. And so given your testimony now about moving the bond sale, if you hadn't made an assumption to move the bond sale, would the money required to cover the shortfall instead of being $13 million over the next biennium be $23
million? Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that's correct.
Thank you.
The school shift buyback, $290 million approximately in fiscal year 12 and 13, will increase our K-12 spending by that amount. And so overall, we will see an increase in spending in the current biennium of $227 million. Trickles into the next biennium as well, so it offsets our savings slightly. Overall, we have seen this is the third forecast where we have bought back school shift. It's the fourth forecast in a row where we have seen a positive balance in the current biennium, allowing us to fully restore our reserves and buy down our school shift. We have approximately $800 million of school shift remaining, and $250 of that is payment shift, and $550 of that is the property tax recognition shift.
Representative Denmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And being that we're in the K-12 shift, being with the new budget that forecast that we have, do you think the governor will then pay back that shift during this biennium, or is he going to wait until the 2016-2017?
Mr. Chair, I think the governor is going to release a supplemental budget sometime during the week of March 11th, and I can't speak to what that's going to include yet.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. And I used to be on K-12, so I was more current on this. And I know we've dug into the old shift that was pre-existing, what we did last time. Can you just tell me, I know, because we've paid back what we borrowed, I think, and we're into the old. Can you just tell me those numbers offhand? Because I don't remember them. The deal we did in 2011 and how much we're into the old part. Just...
I'm going to refer to a table on page 71, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler. We had on page 71 of our forecast document, it provides a nice history of the times when you've used the school shift and the extent to which we have used it. But going into the 2011 session, we had in the 9 and 10 session shifted from 90-10 down to 70-30. And in the 20, and the law provided to pay back that entire shift in the budget for the 12-13 budget. As a part of the $5 billion solution, you redid the shift down to 70-30 and added down to 60-40. And so now we have bought back shift to about 86.5.
Oh. So we're, Mr. Chair, so we're...
Mr. Weber.
So we added 10, is that what we did? Under our watch, and then we paid back 16 more. Is that just to summarize? Okay, thank you. That's all I wanted to know.
Depends on how Representative Abler you talk about whose watch. I think we were dealing... When we were dealing with the shift, we were dealing with a fellow by the name of Palente.
Yeah.
Just to remind you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I've been here 14 years, and in those 14 years, I've had 2 years I was actually in charge of something, so where I had a say in. So that's what I'm just thinking in my head. I wasn't even trying to be political.
Representative Abler, I've been fortunate to have a year or two more than that.
Weren't you the education chair?
I was for about 20 years one education committee or another, so I understand shifts, and I made a career of trying to pay them back. The first shift that I dealt with was Governor Cui. Had a shift as part of his budget balancing. Remember, we had 6 special sessions. And then for many years, probably even predating that, we had with the technical colleges what we call the 85-15 shift that was just rolled forward until... one of our fiscal analysts, when we happened to have some money, said, Chair Carlson, can we pay back part of that? Because it was every time we would deal with any technical college, because they were locally controlled then. Formula changes, we had to account for that 85-15. And then when the merger took place, that was paid back in its entirety because a state agency can't go into debt. And we were able to carry a shift for the technical colleges when they were locally controlled by the school district. So when I say I've had a career dealing with shifts, not of my making necessarily, just trying to reduce the cost. But I think historically the first shift ever was in the early 80s with Governor Cui, but that may predate everybody at the table here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we got Representative Holbert next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Kelly, can you show how the change in the budget reserve number from November to February is reflected in this graph? In that November, we lowered the reserve amount to reflect the funding for the flood relief.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, that's a technical correction we will be making and releasing in the next few days. So what Representative Holberg is speaking to is that during the special session this summer, we spent around $30 million, I believe, out of the reserves. I could be wrong on that exact number, to pay for a flood. And a provision in that flood bill required that we not replenish the budget reserves in November if there was a positive balance, and that we go to the school shift to replenish that. And so current law requires that if there's a positive balance, first we restore the reserves, and second we start paying back school shift, first the the shift payment, and second the property tax recognition payment. And the flood bill required us to skip provision A and to go directly to paying back the school shift. It was for the November forecast only, meaning that in this forecast we should have first restored this reserve and then bought down the shift. And we did it in the wrong order. We will be correcting and updating our forecast to reflect the reserves being fully restored first. And so that will actually add more to the reserves that's showing in this forecast. It will reduce the school shift buyback from $290 million to something in the $280 million range. We are working with education to calculate that.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Detmer, I moved on pretty quickly. Were you done?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to backtrack to Representative Abler's remarks. And Representative Marquardt could probably do a better job of this than I could, but the issue of the old and the new, you know, I think if you really look at the shift in 2010, it was meant to be paid off in the next budget cycle. So in a sense, you added 10 and retained 20 in the 2011 budget. So that's, I mean, you could say the same thing about us if we don't pay the shift off this session, but technically I think it's not fair to say the old and the new, because that shift was intended to be paid off in the next budget cycle, and it wasn't. That was the choice of the 2011 budget, so that 30% goes together. It's my assessment. Anybody else can comment on that as well.
Okay, we have Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the commissioner, or actually, if maybe the chair of the K-12 Finance Committee or our Republican lead here may know this as well, but just to try to help me put the $1.9 billion that's being repaid to the schools in more per-student perspective, because I'm assuming that goes back to each school on an equal per-pupil basis, what would that equate to per pupil? That our schools are getting. Do you happen to know that?
Mr. Chair, I do not. We can certainly find that out for you, though.
Okay. Yeah, I'd just be curious to know how that's equating to each of our schools.
I think Mr. Marks has something to add on this one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, there are slightly under 1 million pupil units in schools, so you could do the math from that perspective, I think.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hagbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kelly, or Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, or Director Kelly, my question is about the shortfall in the gambling revenues for the charitable gaming and to pay back the pay the debt service on the bonds that are going to be let. Representative Holberg touched on it a little bit. Could you explain exactly what Representative Holberg was talking about there, just so the rest of the committee understands where we're at? And also, could you tell us exactly, once we start letting these bonds, what is the average payback annually on the debt service? Is that about $35 million, something like that, annually that we're going to have to pay back? What's the estimate on that? And what did the language say in that bill? Did that say that the general fund is going to back those bonds? Some people, I believe, are under the assumption that this gambling revenue that's coming to the state of Minnesota is going to be set aside in a separate pool of money or something, and then that's going to go to pay that back the debt service on the bonds, and I don't think that's correct. But I believe the general fund is going to back those bonds, and it doesn't really matter if we have more revenue coming in from the pull tabs or not, that if we have enough revenue in the general fund, there's money there to pay the debt service. So I know there's a lot of talk lately in the news about not coming up short with the gambling proceeds to pay back these bonds, but maybe that's not necessarily needed. Maybe if there's enough money from other taxes, from income taxes, sales taxes, other things that go to the general fund, maybe we don't need that gambling revenue to come in. So could you explain a little bit exactly what's happening with all of this?
Who wants to take that one? Commissioner Showalter?
Mr. Chair, Representative, thanks. Thank you for the question, and it's a great transition to the next slide. So I'm going to take it and try to address as many of the questions as I can. Feel free to follow up in case I've missed any, because this next slide basically shows the assumptions in the forecast on gambling revenue. The structure of the Vikings stadium bill basically has two components, and they're linked only by the presence of both of them in the general fund.
Yes.
On the one hand, you have the revenues coming from pull tabs, deep pull tabs in particular, and you have the spending coming from the debt service to support the stadium. Both of them are housed within the general fund, but they're not directly linked. Although they are talked about as being linked, they are not. And in both in the law and in financially, the bonds that are being sold by the state, or that will be sold by the state for the Viking Stadium, are essentially general fund appropriation bonds. There's nothing in it that directly says e-pull tabs revenue. That being said, we very consciously try to manage the risk of that additional cost by having a revenue stream in the Viking Stadium bill. That revenue stream was the e-pull tabs, and the variability on that, given that it was a new activity, was high. So as a result, the bill was structured so that there was a reserve that would allow what we were anticipating coming in from reserves to pile up to help basically deal with the uncertainty of the long-term revenue stream or the variability of that revenue stream. And what you see in this graphic here is how that moved. In the original estimates, the dark area here in the upper left-hand corner was essentially the reserve fund within the general fund for the stadium construction, keeping all of the e-pull tab revenues that were to come in before the prior to any construction activities themselves. Each of the successive forecasts, that amount has decreased because the take-up of e-pull tabs has been far slower than originally anticipated. We had initially anticipated, even in the November forecast, about 900 locations of e-pull tabs. As of this moment, we have around 130 sites running. So because of that, and because of a lower per-site revenue estimate, you see that that head start that we had anticipated in the stadium plan being lower. What that matches up to, as you are asking, is what is the spending number that's shown here? Basically, all that's happened in this forecast is we know that the stadium isn't being constructed right now. We're not selling bonds for a construction activity that's not occurring. We, based upon the latest information we've gotten from the Vikings and the Stadium Authority, anticipate that the state's dollars will be needed in roughly an August, September kind of time frame. We're going to get more information on that, but for purposes of this forecast, we assume that would start in August. On an annual basis, The numbers that were shown at the time of the legislation and that are shown in this forecast are about $33 million in annual debt service for those bonds. That's the comparison that you're looking at here. That's the parameters that will still allow us to go forward with a bond issue this whenever it's necessary to support the stadium. But it does raise, I think, the question of doing better to make sure that we've got the revenues going forward. We still have only a few sites up. We certainly want more sites. We just want to make sure that the take-up rate is fast enough to support the revenue projections that are in this forecast. And that's, I think, the question of the management question and the revenue question that is raised by this forecast.
Commissioner, could you comment with the briefing we had the other day, at least the sites that are up, and I think we all understand that there's a limited number online, but you also used a number of $200 and some that was anticipated from each site, and it's at about 50%. What do you see happening there long term?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, good question. The revenue per site was estimated around $206 on a net basis per site per day. Based upon the sampling we've got right now, without any pull tabs being in there, the estimates now are at about $100 per site per day. So that is a significant drop in the revenue per site, but it's also sort of helpful to know that there is clearly a very clear sort of revenue per site that's persisted even after that initial take-up and initial launch in some of the sites that were wildly successful. So what I think we have to do is see how that plays out as it grows, as we have more sites, because some sites have been running well above that revenue estimate and below. And so this estimate is a more conservative estimate about the revenue per site as we get it into more locations. Also, I work out the bingo, the Link Bingo game. That is included in these numbers, but right now that's not being run anywhere.
And another question, the $50 million that the Vikings are supposed to put in up front, is that calculated in this revenue, or how do we look at that in terms of what the short-term need is?
Sure. Mr. Chair, the stadium financing had the Vikings put up the first $50 million. The next $50 million comes from the state. Right now, activities such as the architectural work, out of the planning work, any site work, is coming out of that first $50 million from the Vikings. And so when I talked about getting detailed cost estimates, it is how our activity is going to be phased as we get more detailed information from their construction team about using up that first $50 million and when are we going to go to the next $50 million from the state.
Okay, and then Commissioner, I assume because the title of this chart is lower gambling revenues anticipated, so then when we look at the revenue coming in, that is just gambling revenue. That's not calculating the $50 million in at all.
Correct.
Okay. You had a follow-up. I'm sorry. Representative Hackbarth, I didn't realize you had a follow-up. Representative
Hackbarth. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I am correct when I say that the general fund is backing these bonds, and whether we bring any more gambling revenue in or not, the general fund is going to be on the hook for paying these bonds back over, I can't remember what it is, 20 years or whatever it is. The general fund is going to be paying these regardless whether we get any more gambling revenue or not. And members, I'd just like to let you know that I've been checking with a number of different legions and different people that do these things, and there's a lot of American legions and VFWs that don't have these now, and they're telling me that they're not asking for them. They don't want them. Their people don't want them. The people that are coming there to play the paper pull tabs and are there playing bingo now, they don't want electronic bingo. They don't want electronic pull tabs. So I'm not sure exactly what your marketing strategy is or who's working on this, but I have a feeling that, and like I said a year ago, that folks aren't going to like these things. This has never been done anywhere. We were forecasting way too much at that time in the revenue that was going to be brought in. And checking with folks now, they don't want these things. So I don't know where we're going to get the money, if you're going to kick in with the scratch-offs and those other things that were supposed to back these things. Even that is not going to bring in enough revenue to cover the debt service on the $33 million annually. But I just want folks to know that what they voted for was a general fund expenditure to back these bonds.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, As I mentioned earlier, this is a place where I think we need to do better. That the revenue stream that we're seeing here is still developing, and we need to know more about which sites are looking for, which ones aren't. Even as we at the release of the forecast, certainly the charitable gaming group was suggesting that there is interest out there. Certainly in looking at some of the work that Tom Barrett and the Gambling Control has had, they have had plenty of interest, but there's also an organizational aspect to this of distributors, long-time relationships with individual places and the charities that are working them, the regulatory aspect, taking time to get those games out. There's a lot of issues here, and I think it's just an important aspect to say we had hoped that this would run faster than it is, and I think it's up to all of us to look at how we can do this better, and whether there's management changes, law changes, just oversight changes to make sure that we can assure the revenues that we'd anticipated in our forecast.
Representative Hackbarth, are you?
I'm done.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Showalter. I'm just looking at the chart that you have up titled Lower Gambling Revenues. I'm looking at the bottom February 13th forecast. And the top bar of the two bars in the bottom, there's a little tiny little thumbnail thickness of black, which is revenue. And I'm guessing that that is our wildly successful collections. From this, could you tell how much money is that right now,
Mr. Chair, Representative? That's the $1.8 million.
Okay. And Mr. Chair and Representative Showalter, or excuse me, Commissioner Showalter, part of the you know discomfort a lot of us have with this particular development is that when members of my caucus and the other caucus voted for this, one of the assurances was that this was not general fund money. They say, "Oh, I can go home and I can vote for this as long as I can tell my people this is not general fund money," and that there was a strong connection between the fact that they were voting for this and it was not general fund. And that relied on people in VFWs collecting these and distributing them to their patrons in hopes that they would somehow generate a new revenue stream heretofore not seen in the state of Minnesota, and somehow that we were going to rely upon that revenue stream. Some of us at the time, as I don't recall, not being very persuaded by that. And moving forward, I think that the connection between the general fund and what we're talking about here, the gambling revenues as the stadium moves forward, really is something that we need to be honest about and talk to constituents about in real time. And I know that you are doing that and trying to do that with your testimony before committees. And I would just encourage legislators to really, whether you voted for it or voted against it, to look back at this and to be a little bit more honest, a little bit more clear with people as we're communicating how we're going to pay for this doggone thing.
And Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate where you're going. And I think part of our shared challenge is to make sure that we do try to manage this so that the general fund isn't impacted, because that clearly was the intent of the legislators at the time. And that goes to my comment about some sites doing well and demonstrating that there is revenue streams, at least in some places, and that we need to do better in getting that rolled out. The other part is that managing the financing of the deal. What you see again is the assumption that we would be selling all of our bonds at one time with basically the initial assumptions that were used at the time of the legislative enactment, and that those costs over the first couple of years. We have some ability to structure this, and we'll try to make sure that we manage the expenditure side along with trying to improve the revenue side.
Mr. Chair.
Lance and Dean.
I don't know if you know this, but I really honestly don't know the answer to this. I just put together a list of do's and don't do's for freshmen and asking questions in committee, and I based it off of Representative Holberg because she's really good at it. And one of the things is you're not supposed to ask questions that you don't know the answer to, but I honestly don't know this. Have we built buildings? We got revenue bonds, GO bonds, federal trunk highway bonds that we use to build buildings. Have we ever passed a bill that said we're going to build a building with money that was not from one of those sources? Have we ever said that we're going to pay for construction of something outside of one of those or to back those bonds? Because I really don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the question, I just want to make sure I understand the question, is have we built a building not using GO bonds? Or?
Well, there's revenue, there's trunk highway that we've used for construction within the bonding committee. Have we ever said we're going to use gambling to back bonds before, or have we ever said that we're going to, charge a fee to the zoo and have that back the bonds, or have we ever done anything like that before?
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, we haven't. The general fund has backed construction without a corresponding revenue source. I think of some of the TCF Bank Stadium, the bioscience buildings at the University of Minnesota. Both are appropriation bonds essentially being issued by the University of Minnesota, analogous to what we're doing for the stadium. There just wasn't at that time a corresponding new revenue to go with them.
Fairly, that's an interesting question, Commissioner. What came to my mind when he was asking it is the authorization that we give. I'm trying to remember, it's a very tiny state agency with one or two people that monitors the construction of buildings on private college campuses, and the private colleges have their own revenue stream to pay those bonds. I think the state issues the bonds, and then the private colleges agree to pay those bonds through that small state agency. I don't know if that would directly apply to what Representative Dean was asking about, or another one that comes to mind is revenue from tuition, or not tuition, but the fees that are charged for the construction of dormitories, for example, on our state university campuses. Now, those are revenue bonds, and the revenue stream is the rent that they basically charge the students.
And Mr. Chair, absolutely, there are, especially on the revenue side, certain guarantees, other things that the state does in some of the bond pools that is supported basically by the revenue of participants in the pool.
And I think, Representative Dean, that's what basically you were asking, wasn't it, or did I misunderstand your question?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Hausman probably could answer it better, but I know that within the bonding committee we've got the revenue bonds, trunk highway bonds, GO bonds, and I've never known that we have ever connected directly in legislation before a different revenue stream to the repayment of that as we did with the Viking Stadium, and maybe we have. I know that in revenue, if we're going to build a parking ramp and we charge people money, that's a revenue source that we attach to a revenue bond. But I'm not aware of any historical precedent for anything like this, and I was just wondering if anybody else was aware of anything.
Representative Hausman,
I think he's probably described the dilemma well. The appropriation bond is the category under which, and it works not quite the way this was anticipated to work. But this will, I think, be an appropriation bond.
Okay, Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I find myself slightly embarrassed to be in agreement with Representative Hackbarth, but I also voted against the Vikings bill, and my major reason was that I thought that the financial projections were totally out of place. I'm someone who doesn't frequent pull tab places or anything like that, but from everything I've heard, the theory behind the electronic pull tabs was to get the new electronic generation in to use them. And if any of you talk to members of the new electronic generation, they have no interest in going to bars and using pull tabs. They'd much rather be at home using Twitter or Facebook. Anyway, the other issue is that the social people also inform me about the social aspect of pull tabs. People kind of like that. They buy a pile of them and they pass them around in a circle, and they all cheer as they take turns. You don't get any of that with the electronic pull tabs. And the third thing is, I'd like to say something about something which has which we haven't talked about here, is that one of the other backups is to have a special Vikings themed lottery ticket. Well, I think that's a clear example of supplanting lottery funds, so you better make sure that that's covered in the law, because it's also definitely been shown that any time you add a new lottery ticket, the total pool of the lottery does not increase at all. It just takes away from existing lottery funds. So I think that ought to be totally out of line. And I hope somebody will look for a serious new source of revenue as this one more clearly fails. And I hope that all of you who voted for the Vikings bill are feeling appropriately chagrined.
No guarantee on that last one.
Oh, and then my final comment is that Representative Dean, as far as I understand, it's only lawyers who only ask a question that they know the answer to, and architects always ask questions that they don't know the answer to. So I hope you haven't forgone your true profession. But any comments?
I think there were several of us that are sitting in this committee that were in the same position that you and Representative Hackworth have commented on.
Okay. I didn't name names. I just allowed people to self-identify. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we are on television, so the viewing audience can find out who voted for it against the stadium, I guess, is what's happening here.
Okay.
The intent was not necessarily to have a hearing on the stadium, but it's quickly evolving into that.
It happened.
Representative Hackworth, you have another question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify with Representative Dean that he made a statement about he wanted the department and everybody to be truthful about what's happening with this, and that's very true, but Representative Dean, the truth is coming out now. And we tried to make those points before we voted on the bill, and people didn't want to listen to it. That was the time for truth, and it didn't come out. We tried to make it aware of people, but even on the House floor when we voted on it that day, I had people coming up to me and telling me that no, the general fund does not back these bonds, that it's a separate account that's going to be paying for the stadium, and we have these backups in place to pay for it, which is absolutely not true. The general fund backs it up. Now the truth is coming out. The time for the truth was back then before we voted on the bill.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and Representative Kahn, I'm not sure if I'm chagrined, but I did vote for it. And I knew the money was somewhat soft, and so now we're realizing what soft means. And I'm not trying to pile on, I'm just interested. It's always all I watch is Representative Brainerd, I know that, but you'll discover as the session weighs on that some people's opinions will weigh more heavily than others' opinions in the final product. Just to the whichever of you knows about this, so you're predicting $46 million or so in this biennium coming up, I think, of revenue, which is way less than before, and that's reflected. Representative Holbrook asked about that before, about the net change. I'm just telling who's ever making decisions as this moves along that you might have the forecast next year saying, by the way, we're short $20 more million than what we thought now off projections. And so, Representative Showalter, I guess I ask you, since you're the head there, is how do you feel about the number that you've got for 14 and 15? Is that, if you got marketing guys ready to go out to places at Hackforth and cons say people aren't going to buy anything at, you have like Friday sales meetings, and do they like have the happy hour time? They come back and hang their head. And I mean, is there, and I'm being a little facetious, but is there a real plan that you think can actually make this happen, since it hasn't gone at all like you thought?
Mr. Chair, Representative, a great question because, you know, the I think one of the issues that is raised by this is an organizational one of who's responsible for getting these out, because everyone has slightly different roles, but there's not an organization that's really sitting there saying, yes, this is our project, we are out there marketing this, making that happen. And that could be the Charitable Gambling Association, it could be, I don't think it's the regulators, but you know, it's like right now there's a number of interested parties, but there's not necessarily a unifying presence. And I think that's one of the questions that really could be looked at, on how you drive change, how you drive improvements in it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
And I'm, you know, I just want to remind people that Governor Dayton should never get rid of, never miss, always get a surplus, Commissioner Showalter. So I'm, you know, so there's a rabbit foot bit here, which, but I think there is some, it's not my topic area, but I think somebody should decide whose job it is and assign some responsibility and put a couple FTEs on it. As, I mean, there must be somebody in charge, but if you don't think somebody's in charge, somebody needs to be in charge, and that's our job as overseers. So I think that'd be a good proposal that maybe Representative Atkins would be in charge of, and his committee, something or other. So anyway, good luck. I just think this number is soft, and I'm afraid next year you're going to come back and we have to reduce human services or something else to fill the hole.
I was reminded the agency I was referring to was the Higher Ed Finance Authority, that small two-person agency that deals with construction on private college campuses, and I think daycare centers on our public college campuses with their own revenue streams. But let's see, Representative Hausman, I think, is next.
Yes, Mr. Chair, to Representative Hackbarth's point, members, I don't know about any of the rest of your speeches. I remember mine very clearly, and it was a very clear statement about exactly like this. And maybe some of you remember. It was very clearly, if any of you think you aren't voting for general fund money for the Vikings, it is simply not the way this is going to happen. And so I don't think there was a very clear telling of the truth on the House floor, and if people were paying attention, there were very clear statements of this problem, exactly as we have it.
Okay, we have Representative Anderson next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And given all this talk about the stadium, what is kind of the backup plan? Because obviously none of us want to see the general fund dollars in real terms being used. That was the whole point of having this gambling revenue as a source to fund for this. So what is Governor Dayton proposing to, how is he, does he plan to fund this, given the fact that the original funding source is not doing as it's supposed to, and I'm assuming that the blink-ons aren't going to be enough to cover the balance either. And I just noticed something as a Hennepin County legislator. I just noticed that there's talk of potentially taking the Twin Stadium tax money to fill in for the Viking Stadium, and want to know if the governor has stated a position on that, and voice my concern over doing that.
Commissioner, Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not aware of any statement of support for that idea from the governor. And really, I think this forecast and these estimates of equal tab revenues is the start of that conversation about how to, first of all, make sure that we manage the revenue estimates and the process to realize those revenue estimates better. And that's the first thing he said in the press conference after the forecast release, and I expect that there will be a discussion and action along those lines. I think the second thing in terms of backing up the cost is trying to manage the costs on the financing and the structuring of the bonds to make sure that we have the best numbers available and that we can match the revenue year by year. The estimates over time still balance out. What the question is right now, that obviously the equal tab revenues are not coming in as fast as anticipated. The statutory fallbacks are already mentioned in discussion. It's the sweet tax, it's the additional lottery game. Those are decisions, I think, that are still further down the road. Right now, I think the management question is on those first two things of making sure the revenues are realized within current law and making sure that the expenditures are managed also within current law. If there's additional changes that the legislature wants to make or additional management changes, I think that's the discussion that we should be having now.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Showalter. At one point, Governor Dayton had mentioned putting machines in grocery stores. Is that something that he has decided not to do, or has he changed his perspective, or what is his position currently on those issues?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the governor really is looking at the Viking Stadium proposal as it's currently stated and trying to make it work and trying to look at the equal tab revenues, which are successful in a number of locations, but getting it into more locations than is currently found, making sure that charities team up with distributors to install the games so that we can support both the revenue estimates that are here and hopefully roll out successful and more information about what we should expect on the revenues in the future.
Thank you. Well, I think the unfortunate reality is that we already have $13 million that should have been going to pay back the shift that is now being set aside for Vikings money. Mm-hmm. I mean, this forecast baked in the cake has $13 million of general fund money going for debt service for a Vikings stadium, and absent the Vikings bill, the shift would have gotten $13 million more paid back. I mean, so I think that, you know, we're 6 months out from, you know, when this bill passed or whatever, and already who's paying? The kids are paying for the Vikings stadium. I mean, if you boil it right down. I mean, that's how weird this is.
Representative Dabney. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Picking up a bit after where Representative Anderson stopped, when do we hit the point where the fallbacks, the triggers, the seat licenses and lottery games and the like have to be brought on?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think great question, and I don't have a firm timeline. But I think probably one of those points of getting more information and having more better assessment of where we're at is later this summer when we consider what the financing options for the stadium are, when we've got the construction schedule in hand, and we have a few more months of rollout of the equal tabs to see if we continue to see significantly lower underperformance or if it starts to track where we would expect. So, to me, that timeline is a natural point where we're going to have a lot more information.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Showalter, if I recall correctly from your earlier testimony, the administration was initially looking at a February 1 bond sale and is now looking at an August 1 bond sale. What's the probability that you will go forward with an August 1 bond sale if the e-poll tabs are not providing the revenue anticipated in the original bill?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would expect that the plan will continue or the financing discussion will continue. The hypothetical, if there's something catastrophic, I'm sure we would all come back and look at it, but right now, given what we've seen, and given what we're anticipating seeing in the next few months, we will be looking at financing it this summer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, that seems to conclude the questions on this page dealing with the Vikings. but we do have one more page, I think, that Ms. Kelly should probably touch upon before we adjourn, and that's fiscal 16 and 17, if you want to touch on that just very briefly, and then we're getting close to adjournment.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Looking forward, we see slight improvement in our fiscal year 16-17 estimates, and again, these are just planning estimates. They are a little more squishy than our forecast for 14 and 15. There is improvement both in revenue and the continued growth in spending. The gap shrinks from $627 million in fiscal year 14 to a positive $548 million in fiscal year 17. The spending side does not include any general inflation estimates, and if you were to add that in, it's about $1.3 billion in inflation by fiscal year 17.
And I think it's important, if I understand that inflation number correctly, that that's based on current law. So changes that would take place in 14 and 15 would influence one way or another that bottom line number then of the 1.3 you just referenced. Am I correct on that?
Correct, Mr. Chair. The spending is adjusted in 14 and 15 based on changes where there are forecasted programs for enrollment or cost per participant, and those are pushed forward into 16-17, but nothing else is inflated.
So pending action, that number could go up or down, is my
correct
point. Okay. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. And just on this structural balance thing, I'm interested in the inflation numbers. And those would be cumulative. Those are each year. So if you wanted to add up the 4 years, they'd have to add up all four numbers. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. And so I'm curious, in my arena, the human service one, we could easily spend all of $268 million on just a 2 or 3% COLA for nursing homes and disabled services. And so that you just put an inflation factor of like 1% or something on that number, just as a number. It's not tied to any specific stuff you would do and general needs. It's just an inflation number. Is that right?
Correct, Mr. Chair. I believe it's 1.6 or 1.7% across all spending.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? We do have the minutes, and actually people have received two sets, right? We did discover early in the meeting that there was an error on the first set of minutes, so disregard that one. And Representative Hausman, did you get a chance to look at the second set of minutes?
I did.
Representative Hausman moves their approval. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. I want to thank the three of you for the hearing this morning, and with that, meeting adjourned.